Okay, here's a recording to help guide you through the short story, What Men Live By. This is a shorter version of what is a longer story or book by Leo Tolstoy. A shoemaker named Simon, who had neither house nor land of his own, lived with his wife and children in a peasant's hut and earned his living by his work. Work was cheap, but bread was dear, and what he earned, he spent for food. The man and his wife had but one sheepskin coat between them for winter wear, and even that was torn to tatters. And this was the second year he had been wanting to buy sheepskins for a new coat. Before winter, Simon saved up a little money. A 3-ruble note lay hidden in his wife's box, and 5 rubles and 20 kopecks were owed him by customers in the village. So one morning he prepared to go to the village to buy the sheepskins. He put on over his shirt his wife's wadded nankin jacket, and over that he put his own cloth coat. He took the 3-ruble note in his pocket, cut himself a stick to serve as a staff, and started off after breakfast. "I'll collect the 5 rubles that are due to me," thought he. "Add the 3 I've got, and that will be enough to buy sheepskins for the winter coat." He came to the village and called at a peasant's hut, but the man was not at home. The peasant's wife promised that the money should be paid next week, but she would not pay it herself. Then Simon called on another peasant, but this one swore he had no money and would only pay 20 kopecks, which he owed for a pair of boots Simon had mended. Simon then tried to buy the sheepskins on credit, but the dealer would not trust him. "Bring your money," said he. "Then you may have your pick of the skins. We know what debt collecting is like." So all the business the shoemaker did was to get the 20 kopecks for boots he had mended and to take a pair of felt boots a peasant gave him to sole with leather. Simon felt downhearted. He spent the 20 kopecks on vodka and started homewards without having bought any skins. In the morning he had felt the frost, but now, after drinking the vodka, he felt warm, even without a sheepskin coat. He trudged along, striking his stick on the frozen earth with one hand, swinging the felt boots with the other, and talking to himself. "I'm quite warm," said he. "Though I have no sheepskin coat. I've had a drop, and it runs through all my veins. I need no sheepskins. I go along and don't worry about anything. That's the sort of man I am. What do I care? I can live without sheepskins. I don't need them. My wife will fret, to be sure. And true enough, it is a shame. One works all day long and then does not get paid. Stop a bit. If you don't bring that money along, sure enough, I'll skin you. Blessed if I don't." "How's that?" "He pays 20 kopecks at a time. What can I do with 20 kopecks? Drink it. That's all one can do. Hard up, he says he is. So he may be, but what about me? You have a house and cattle and everything. I've only what I stand up in. You have corn on your growing. I have to buy every grain. I must spend 3 rubles every week for bread alone. I come home and find the bread all used up, and I have to fork out another ruble and a half. So just pay up what you owe and no nonsense about it." By this time, he had nearly reached the shrine at the bend of the road. Looking up, he saw something whitish behind the shrine. The daylight was fading, and the shoemaker peered at the thing without being able to make out what it was. There was no white stone here before. Can it be an ox? It's not like an ox. It has a head like a man, but it's too white. And what could a man be doing there? He came closer so that it was clearly visible. To his surprise, it really was a man, alive or dead, sitting naked, leaning motionless against the shrine. Terror seized the shoemaker, and he thought, "Someone has killed him, stripped him, and left him there. If I meddle, I shall surely get into trouble." So the shoemaker went on. He passed in front of the shrine so that he could not see the man. When he had gone some way, he looked back and saw that the man was no longer leaning against the shrine, but was moving, as if looking towards him. The shoemaker felt more frightened than before and thought, "Shall I go back to him or shall I go on? If I go near him, something dreadful may happen. Who knows who the fellow is? He has not come here for any good. If I go near him, he may jump up and throttle me. There will be no getting away. Or if not, he'd still be a burden on one's hands. What could I do with a naked man? I couldn't give him my last clothes. Heaven only helped me to get away. So the shoemaker hurried on, leaving the shrine behind him, when suddenly his conscience smote him and he stopped in the road. "What are you doing, Simon?" said he to himself. "The man may be dying of want and you slip past afraid. Have you grown so rich as to be afraid of robbers? Ah, Simon, shame on you." So he turned back and went up to the man. Simon approached the stranger, looked at him, and saw that he was a young man, fit, with no bruises on his body, only evidently freezing and frightened. And he sat there leaning back without looking up at Simon, as if too faint to lift his eyes. Simon went close to him, and then the man seemed to wake up. Turning his head, he opened his eyes and looked into Simon's face. That one look was enough to make Simon fond of the man. He threw the felt boots on the ground, undid his sash, laid it on the boots, and took off his cloth coat. "It's not a time for talking," said he. "Come, put this coat on at once." And Simon took the man by the elbows and helped him to rise. As he stood there, Simon saw that his body was clean and in good condition, his hands and feet shapely, and his face good and kind. He threw his coat over the man's shoulders, but the latter could not find the sleeves. Simon guided his arms into them, and drawing the coat well on, wrapped it closely about him, tying the sash around the man's waist. Simon even took off his torn cap to put it on the man's head, but then his own head felt cold, and he thought, "I'm quite bald, while he has long curly hair," so he put his cap on his own head again. "It will be better to give something for his feet," thought he, and he made the man sit down and helped him to put on the felt boots, saying, "There, friend, now move about and warm yourself. Other matters can be settled later on. Can you walk?" The man stood up and looked kindly at Simon, but could not say a word. "Why don't you speak?" said Simon. "It's too cold to stay here. We must be getting home. There now, take my stick, and if you're feeling weak, lean on that. Now step out." The man started walking and moved easily, not lagging behind. As they went along, Simon asked, "And where do you belong to?" "I'm not from these parts." "I thought as much. I know the folks hereabouts. But how did you come to be there by the shrine?"
"I cannot tell."
"Has someone been ill-treating you?"
"No one has ill-treated me. God has punished me."
"Of course, God rules all. Still, you'll have to find food and shelter somewhere. Where do you want to go to?"
"It's all the same to me."
Simon was amazed. The man did not look like a rogue, and he spoke gently, but yet he gave no account of himself. Still, Simon thought, who knows what may have happened? And he said to the stranger, "Well, then, come home with me and at least warm yourself a while." So Simon walked towards his home, and the stranger kept up with him, walking at his side. The wind had risen, and Simon felt it cold under his shirt. He was getting over his tipsiness by now and began to feel the frost. He went along sniffling and wrapping his wife's coat round him, and he thought to himself, "There now, talk about sheepskins. I went out for sheepskins and come home without even a coat to my back, and what is more, I'm bringing a naked man along with me. Matryona won't be pleased." And when he thought of his wife, he felt sad. But when he looked at the stranger and remembered how he had looked up at him at the shrine, his heart was glad. Simon's wife had everything ready early that day. She cut wood, brought water, fed the children, eaten her own meal, and now she sat thinking. She wondered when she ought to make bread, now or tomorrow. There was still a large piece left. "If Simon has had some dinner in town," thought she, "and does not eat much for supper, the bread will last out another day." She weighed the piece of bread in her hand again and again and thought, "I won't make any more today. We have only enough flour left to bake one batch. We can manage to make this last out till Friday." So Matryona put away the bread and sat down at the table to patch her husband's shirt. While she worked, she thought how her husband was buying skins for a winter coat. "If only the dealer does not cheat him. My good man is much too simple. He cheats nobody, but any child can take him in. 8 rubles is a lot of money. He should get a good coat at that price. Not tan skins, but still a proper winter coat. How difficult it was last winter to get on without a warm coat. I could neither get down to the river nor go out anywhere. When he went out, he put on all we had, and there was nothing left for me. He did not start very early today, but still it's time he was back. I only hope he is not gone on the spree. Hardly had Matryona thought this when steps were heard on the threshold and someone entered. Matryona stuck her needle into her work and went out into the passage. There she saw two men, Simon, and with him a man without a hat and wearing felt boots. Matryona noticed at once that her husband smelled of spirits. There now, he has been drinking, thought she. And when she saw that he was coatless, had only her jacket on, brought no parcel, stood there silent and seemed ashamed, her heart was ready to break with disappointment. He has drunk the money, thought she, and has been on the spree with some good-for-nothing fellow whom he's brought home with him. Matryona let them pass into the hut, followed them in, and saw that the stranger was a young, slight man wearing her husband's coat. There was no shirt to be seen under it, and he had no hat. Having entered, he stood neither moving nor raising his eyes, and Matryona thought, he must be a bad man. He's afraid. Matryona frowned and stood beside the oven looking to see what they would do. Simon took off his cap and sat down on the bench as if things were all right. Come, Matryona, if supper is ready, let us have some. Matryona muttered something to herself and did not move, but stayed where she was by the oven. She looked first at the one and then at the other of them and only shook her head. Simon saw that his wife was annoyed, but tried to pass it off. Pretending not to notice anything, he took the stranger by the arm. Sit down, friend, said he, and let us have some supper. The stranger sat down on the bench. Haven't you cooked anything for us? Said Simon. Matryona's anger boiled over. I've cooked, but not for you. It seems to me you have drunk your wits away. You went to buy a sheepskin coat, but come home without so much as the coat you had on, and bring a naked vagabond home with you? I have no supper for drunkards like you. That's enough, Matryona. Don't wag your tongue without reason. You had better ask what sort of man, and you tell me what you've done with the money, she says. Simon found the pocket of the jacket, drew out the 3-ruble note, and unfolded it. Here is the money. Trifonov did not pay, but promises to pay soon. Matryona got still more angry. He had bought no sheepskins, but had put his only coat on some naked fellow and had even brought him to their house. She snatched up the note from the table, took it to put away in safety, and said, I have no supper for you. We can't feed all the naked drunkards in the world. There now, Matryona, hold your tongue a bit. First, hear what a man has to say. Much wisdom I shall hear from a drunken fool. I was right in not wanting to marry you, a drunkard. The linen my mother gave me, you drank, and now you've been to buy a coat and have drunk it too. Simon tried to explain to his wife that he had only spent 20 kopecks, tried to tell how he had found the man, but Matryona would not let him get a word in. She talked 19 to the dozen and dragged in things that had happened 10 years before. Matryona talked and talked, and at last she flew at Simon and seized him by the sleeve. Give me my jacket. It is the only one I have, and you must needs take it from me and wear it yourself. Give it here, you mangy dog, and may the devil take you. Simon began to pull off the jacket and turned a sleeve of it inside out. Matryona seized the jacket, and it burst its seams. She snatched it up, threw it over her head, and went to the door. She meant to go out, but stopped, undecided. She wanted to work off her anger, but she also wanted to learn what sort of man the stranger was. Matryona stopped and said, if he were a good man, he would not be naked. Why, he hasn't even a shirt on him. If he were all right, you would say where you came across the fellow. That's just what I'm trying to tell you, said Simon. As I came to the shrine, I saw him sitting all naked and frozen. It isn't quite the weather to sit about naked. God sent me to him, or he would have perished. What was I to do? How do we know what may have happened to him? So I took him, clothed him, and brought him along. Don't be so angry, Matryona. It is a sin. Remember, we all must die one day. Angry words rose to Matryona's lips, but she looked at the stranger and was silent. He sat on the edge of the bench, motionless,
his hands folded on his knees, his head drooping on his breast, his eyes closed, and his brows knit as if in pain. Matryona was silent, and Simon said, "Matryona, have you no love of God?" Matryona heard these words, and she looked at the stranger. As she looked at the stranger, suddenly her heart softened towards him. She came back from the door, and going to the oven, she got out the supper. Setting a cup on the table, she poured out some kvass. Then she brought out the last piece of bread and set out a knife and spoons. "Eat if you want to," said she. Simon drew the stranger to the table. "Take your place, young man," said he. Simon cut the bread, crumbled it into the broth, and they began to eat. Matryona sat at the corner of the table, resting her head on her hand and looking at the stranger. And Matryona was touched with pity for the stranger and began to feel fond of him. And at once the stranger's face lit up. His brows were no longer bent. He raised his eyes and smiled at Matryona. When they had finished supper, the woman cleared away the things and began questioning the stranger. "Where are you from?" said she. "I'm not from these parts." "But how did you come to be on the road?" "I may not tell." "Did someone rob you?" "God punished me." "And you were lying there naked?" "Yes, naked and freezing. Simon saw me and had pity on me. He took off his coat, put it on me, and brought me here. And you have fed me, given me drink, and shown pity on me. God will reward you." Matryona rose, took from the window Simon's old shirt she had been patching, and gave it to the stranger. She also brought out a pair of trousers for him. "There," said she, "I see you have no shirt. Put this on and lie down where you please, in the loft or on the oven." The stranger took off the coat, put on the shirt, and lay down in the loft. Matryona put out the candle, took the coat, and climbed to where her husband lay. Matryona drew the skirts of the coat over her and lay down, but could not sleep. She could not get the stranger out of her mind. When she remembered that he had eaten their last piece of bread and that there was none for tomorrow, and thought of the shirt and trousers she had given away, she felt grieved. But when she remembered how he had smiled, her heart was glad. Long did Matryona lie awake, and she noticed that Simon also was awake. He drew the coat towards him. "Simon." "Well?" "You've had the last of the bread, and I have not put any to rise. I don't know what we shall do tomorrow. Perhaps I can borrow some of neighbor Martha. If we are alive, we shall find something to eat." The woman lay still a while and then said, "He seems a good man, but why does he not tell us who he is?"
"I suppose he has his reasons."
"Simon."
"Well, we give, but why does nobody give us anything?"
Simon did not know what to say, so he only said, "Let us stop talking," and turned over and went to sleep. In the morning, Simon awoke. The children were still asleep. His wife had gone to the neighbor's to borrow some bread. The stranger alone was sitting on the bench, dressed in the old shirt and trousers, and looking upwards. His face was brighter than it had been the day before. Simon said to him, "Well, friend, the belly wants bread and the naked body clothes. One has to work for a living. What work do you know?"
"I don't know any."
This surprised Simon, but he said, "Men who want to learn can learn anything." "Men work, and I will work also."
"What is your name?"
"Michael." "Well, Michael, if you don't wish to talk about yourself, that is your own affair, but you'll have to earn a living for yourself. If you will work as I tell you, I will give you food and shelter."
"May God reward you. I will learn. Show me what to do."
Simon took yarn, put it round his thumb, and began to twist it.
"It's easy enough, see?"
Michael watched him, put some yarn round his own thumb in the same way, caught the neck, and twisted the yarn also. Then Simon showed him how to wax the thread. This also Michael mastered. Next, Simon showed him how to twist the bristle in, and how to sew, and this too Michael learned at once. Whatever Simon showed him, he understood at once. And after 3 days, he worked as if he had sewn boots all his life. He worked without stopping and ate little. When work was over, he sat silently looking upwards. He hardly went into the street, spoke only when necessary, and neither joked nor laughed. They never saw him smile except that first evening when Matryona gave them supper. Day by day and week by week, the year went round. Michael lived and worked with Simon. His fame spread till people said that no one sewed boots so neatly and strongly as Simon's workman, Michael. And from all the district round, people came to Simon for their boots, and he began to be well off. One winter day, as Simon and Michael sat working, a carriage on sled runners with three horses with bells drove up to the hut. They looked out of the window. The carriage stopped at their door. A fine servant jumped down from the box and opened the door. A gentleman in a fur coat got out and walked up to Simon's hut. Up jumped Matryona and opened the door wide. The gentleman stooped to enter the hut, and when he drew himself up again, his head nearly reached the ceiling, and he seemed quite to fill his end of the room. Simon rose, bowed, and looked at the gentleman with astonishment. He had never seen anyone like him. Simon himself was lean, Michael was thin, and Matryona was dry as a bone. But this man was like someone from another world, red-faced, burly, with a neck like a bull's, and looking altogether as if he were cast in iron. The gentleman puffed, threw off his fur coat, sat down on the bench, and said, "Which of you is the master bootmaker?" "I am, Your Excellency," said Simon, coming forward. Then the gentleman shouted to his lad, "Hey, Fedka, bring the leather." The servant ran in, bringing a parcel. The gentleman took the parcel and put it on the table. "Untie it," said he. The lad untied it. The gentleman pointed to the leather. "Look here, shoemaker," said he. "Do you see this leather?" "Yes, Your Honor." "But do you know what sort of leather it is?" Simon felt the leather and said, "It's good leather." "Good indeed. Why, you fool, you never saw such leather before in your life. It's German and cost 20 rubles." Simon was frightened and said, "Where should I ever see leather like that?" "Just so. Now, can you make it into boots for me?" "Yes, Your Excellency, I can." Then the gentleman shouted at him, "You can you? Well, remember whom you are to make them for and what the leather is. You must make me boots that will wear for a year, neither losing shape nor coming unsewn. If you can do it, take the leather and cut it up. But if you can't, say so. I warn you now, if your boots become unsewn or lose shape within a year, I will have you put in prison. If they don't burst or lose shape for a year, I will pay you 10 rubles for your work." Simon was frightened and did not know what to say. He glanced at Michael and nudged him with his elbow, whispered, "Shall I take the work?" Michael nodded his head as if to say, "Yes, take it." Simon did as Michael advised and undertook to make the boots that would not lose shape or split for a whole year. Calling his servant, the gentleman told him to pull the boot off his left leg, which he stretched out. "Take my measure," said he. Simon stitched a paper measure 17 inches long, smoothed it out, knelt down, wiped his hand well on his apron so as not to soil the gentleman's sock, and began to measure. He measured the sole and round the instep and began to measure the calf of the leg, but the paper was too short. The calf of the leg was as thick as a beam. "Mind you don't make it too tight in the leg." Simon stitched on another strip of paper. The gentleman twitched his toes about in his sock, looking round at those in the hut. And as he did so, he noticed Michael. "Whom have you here? There?" asked he. "That is my workman. He will sew the boots." "Mind," said the gentleman to Michael, "remember to make them so that they will last me a year." Simon also looked at Michael and saw that Michael was not looking at the gentleman, but was gazing into the corner behind the gentleman, as if he saw someone there. Michael looked and looked, and suddenly he smiled, and his face became brighter. "What are you grinning at, you fool?" thundered the gentleman. "You had better look to it that the boots are ready in time." "They shall be ready in good time," said Michael. "Mind it is so," said the gentleman. And he put on his boots and his fur coat, wrapped the ladder round him, and went to the door. But he forgot to stoop and struck his head against the lintel. He swore and rubbed his head. Then he took his seat in the carriage and drove away. When he had gone, Simon said, "There is a figure of a man for you. You could not kill him with a mallet. He almost knocked out the lintel, but did little harm it did to him." And Matryona said, "Living as he does, how should he not grow strong? Death itself can't touch such a rock as that." Then Simon said to Michael, "Well, we have taken the work, but we must see we don't get into trouble over it. The leather is dear, and the gentleman hot-tempered. We must make no mistakes. Come, your eye is truer, and your hands have become nimbler than mine. So you take this measure and cut out the boots. I will finish off the sewing of the vamps." Michael did as he was told. He took the leather, spread it out on the table, folded it in two, took a knife, and began to cut out. Matryona came and watched him cutting and was surprised to see how he was doing it. Matryona was accustomed to seeing boots made, and she looked and saw that Michael was not cutting the leather for boots, but he was cutting it round. She wished to say something, but she thought to herself, "Perhaps I do not understand how gentlemen's boots should be made. I suppose Michael knows more about it, and I won't interfere." When Michael had cut up the leather, he took a thread and began to sew, not with two ends, but as boots are sewn, but with a single end, as for slippers, soft slippers. Again, Matryona wondered, but again she did not interfere. Michael sewed on steadily till noon. Then Simon rose for dinner, looked around, and saw that Michael had made slippers out of the gentleman's leather. "Ah," groaned Simon, and he thought, "how is it that Michael, who has been with me a whole year and never made a mistake before, should do such a dreadful thing? The gentleman ordered high boots, welted with whole fronts, and Michael has made soft slippers with single soles and has wasted the leather. What am I to say to the gentleman? I can never replace leather such as this." And he said to Michael, "What are you doing, friend? You've ruined me. You know the gentleman ordered high boots, but see, what have you made?" Hardly had he begun to rebuke Michael when rat-tat went the iron ring that hung at the door. Someone was knocking. They looked out of the window. A man had come on horseback and was fastening his horse. They opened the door, and the servant who had been with the gentleman came in. "Good day," said he. "Good day," replied Simon. "What can we do for you?" "My mistress has sent me about the boots."
"Well, what about the boots?"
"Why, my master no longer needs them. He is dead."
"Is it possible?"
"He did not live to get home after leaving you, but died in the carriage. When we reached home and the servants came to help him alight, he rolled over like a sack. He was dead already, and so stiff that he could hardly be got out of the carriage. My mistress sent me here saying, 'Tell the bootmaker that the gentleman who ordered the boots of him and left the leather for them no longer needs the boots, but that he must quickly make soft slippers for the corpse. Wait till they are ready and bring them back with you.' That is why I've come." Michael gathered up the remnants of the leather, rolled them up, took the soft slippers he had made, slapped them together, wiped them down with his apron, and handed them and the roll of leather to the servant, who took them and said, "Goodbye, masters, and good day to you."